Now, we're still, we are still 1 week away from the really interesting question of the stolen birthright, because we have two stories to get through first, not to get through, but to examine first, before we'll at least take us this class, maybe this in the next, but probably just this class. And those are the stories, first of all, of another wife-sister swap, so to speak, and second of Isaac digging the wells of his father. So we read at the beginning of chapter 26, we're on chapter 26. We read last time that Isaac stays in Gerar, right? And in fact, if you look at it, it's very interesting. If you look at verse 2, chapter 26, verse 2, God says to Isaac, don't go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I will show you. Now, what does he say to Abraham when Abraham has a famine? Go down to Egypt. We'll talk about why that is in a second. He says, don't go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I'll point to you, which I'll point out to you. Reside in this land. I'll be with you and bless you. Okay? Does this sound familiar? I'll assign all the lands to you and to your offspring, fulfilling the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the heavens. Give your descendants these lands, so all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your offspring, inasmuch as Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my laws, and my teachings. Now, there is one blessing that Isaac doesn't get that Abraham does get. Does anyone remember what that is? God says to Abraham, that's true. Actually, that's half of the blessing, is you will be a father of nations. That's the beginning. And also says to him, I'm looking for where the verse is, your offspring shall seize the gates of their foes. Remember that? Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because it fits with the Isaac that can't go down to Egypt. Right, you have two kids. One of them, you say, you can go away to school. The other one, you say, you know what? You're better off staying at home. Because you know that one of them will survive well in the world, and the other one needs more work, right? So God says to Abraham, there's a famine, go to Egypt. Says to Isaac, there's a famine, stay here, right? And I'll take care of you here, because Isaac's not prepared to go to Egypt. And in fact, you see this even in what happens. Let's look at the story again. Verse 6, Isaac stays in Gerar. When the men of the place ask him about his wife, he said, she's my sister, for he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she's beautiful. Now, we looked at this last time, especially at what it was that Abimelech saw. When some time passed, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out the window, saw Isaac fondling his wife Rebekah. We talked a lot about what that word is and how you translate it and what it means. Abimelech sent for Isaac and said, so she's your wife. Why'd you say she's my sister? Isaac said, I thought I might lose my life on account of her. Abimelech says, what have you done to us? One of the people might have lain with your wife and you would have brought guilt upon us. Abimelech charges all the people saying, anyone who molests this man and his wife shall be put to death. Now, several of us last time said, Abimelech sounds like a better guy than Isaac, right? Abimelech has standards, right? He says, you know, this is a bad thing, and Isaac, as far as he's concerned, he just wants to say it. So Leonard Cass, in his book, says something very interesting. First of all, by the way, just as a parenthetical note, which I didn't say last time, when it says that Esau spurned the birthright, do you remember that phrase, he took and he ate and he spurned? Cass says, at no other place in Genesis does the text pronounce judgment on the deed of any character. Spurned is a judgment that he spurned the birthright, right? That's the only time he says where the text steps back from what someone does and says he shouldn't have done that, which is an interesting observation. Okay. Now, spurn means to disvalue, to not care about, to reject, but reject in a dismissive way.
Snobbish.
Maybe snobbish, but dismissive. Dismissive, like that doesn't mean anything. I don't want that. Okay, it's now, why does he have the Avimelech Isaac encounter? Cass has a really interesting explanation for it that may be true, but it's interesting whether it's true or not. He says, Avimelech's people, who are Avimelech's people? The Philistines, right? They come from Gaza, right? The Philistines lived in Gaza. Avimelech's people do not in the end inherit his gentlemanly virtues, right? Later on, the Philistines are not such great people. Indeed, this might be the text's main purpose in showing us two generations, Abraham and Isaac, dealing with the same Avimelech and his men. A naturally inferior man, that is Isaac. He's saying Isaac is shown deliberately to be inferior to Avimelech as a human being. A naturally inferior man may succeed as the inheritor and perpetuator of righteousness because he lives with God's covenant, whereas a naturally superior man, Avimelech, may fail because his people do not know the Lord. Which is, when you think about it, you say to yourself, why do they show someone better than Isaac? This is what happens again and again, actually, not so much in the Torah, but in the book of Judges. Like, as I've mentioned before, Shimshon, Samson, is a jerk, but he's God's jerk. And because, this is true, and because he's God's jerk, he wins, and the people who oppose God lose, right? And of course, in the end, he's redeemed, which is what happens. In other words, he grows up at the end, which is why he wins. I don't want to, you know, clearly for a long part of the story, he's not a leader. But in the end, after all the sufferings he goes through, he becomes a leader. And by becoming a leader, he proves that he's worth it. But God sticks with him because he's a leader in Israel. And that's clearly a theme through the Torah, right? The theme through the Torah is that it's true that there are great people in the Torah, but even if you're not great, if you're part of God's covenant, ultimately you will be favored. No, well, last time, remember, Ramban says that this is done out of order. He says this is clearly before. As you're pointing out, this scene couldn't be once they're born. It just doesn't fit.
Because otherwise Rebecca's not going to be so
right.
Appealing to the
Philistines. I'm not going to say anything about that. Right, she is not a young maiden. I think that's fair to say. That's fair to say. Right. She is rather a mature woman. Okay. But actually, you're exactly right. The commentators all say that this is out of order. Remember, there is no early or late in the Torah. That's the principle they use, that the Torah doesn't have to tell its stories in order. It tells its stories often to show you developments of character and not necessarily to show you chronological developments. And all the commentators assume that this happened before the birth of the children, especially because the way they put it differently. They say if there were kids running around the house, nobody would believe it's his sister. Right. They don't say that unmarried women are more desirable. Yes.
The commentator that you quoted, does he say anything about the fact that this is kind of early for the Philistines to be in the land?
No, they were in the land before the Israelites. Everybody assumes that.
Really?
So they're the ancestors of the Philistines. I don't think that they're, no, they're not the ancestors. They are the Philistines and called the Philistines. I mean, they don't have, there's no reason why it would be early for them to be in the land, is there? Or is there something that I'm missing?
The Philistines are supposed to be from Greece.
Yeah, they're
and
bronze.
They came in around the 12th century, I understand.
I don't know. I don't know if he says, I don't know if Sarna has anything to say about that, about when the Philistines arrived. I remember in discussions of the chronology of the Bible and here, I don't remember a discussion about the Philistines being there too early, but there's a lot of discussion about camels. There really is. There are camels in Genesis, and there's been more written than you would possibly believe about whether camels, in fact, could have been in the land of Israel at that time. Honest to God, the answer is I don't know. The answer is most modern scholars think not, but it's not conclusive as far as I know. But I don't know about the Philistines, and that I'll have to check. I'll look in the Anchor Dictionary of the Bible will tell me. Yes.
Last year, and a few months ago, we were talking about the LA Times Right.
Like the modern culture in Hebrew,
and yes.
Also the meaning of the word Philistine, which means the opposite or unlearned.
Right. Right, right. In modern English, Philistine means unlearned, and they were sort of redeeming the Philistines because they said the more they discover about them, the more developed the culture was. Well, you have to assume, remember that when you read the Torah, you're getting one side of an argument, right? And think of any argument you ever had. If you only get one side, it's very hard to reconstruct the other. And everybody's saying about how terrible the Philistines are, but we don't have the Philistine side of it. And not only that, but they didn't, as far as we know, we don't have written texts, but we have a material culture. And that lets us know that they were very sophisticated in the way they worked bronze in particular, just like in ancient Rome. You know, Rome was built on the culture of the Etruscans, and the poor Etruscans, I mean, who knows, maybe they were great people, but all we have are some burial cairns and some mounds and a little bit of Etruscan art, and we don't really know what their culture was. So it's a strange thing, actually. The conquered peoples of the world are lucky if they're conquered by someone who endures. The only reason we know about the Philistines at all, or care about the Philistines at all, is because they were conquered by the Israelites, right? Had they been conquered by another people that disappeared, the Philistines would be essentially gone. The Etruscans were lucky enough to be overrun by Rome. So people care about the Etruscans because they were the precursors of Rome. So if you're going to get conquered by somebody who lasts. That's my advice. Or the other way, or give birth to someone who, you know, like in that book, actually, that Lot's Daughters book, he talks about Patrick Bronte. And he says that here's this guy, Patrick Bronte, who was very talented but never would have been remembered except that his daughters were great writers. And as a result, everybody remembers him. So you can go either way. Either get conquered by somebody prominent or give birth to someone prominent. Either one would work. But the other thing that Cass says about this is that, you know, the same Avimelech, who, by the way, again, shows no awareness that he's gone through this before. He doesn't say, your father did this to me too, right? Which makes it strange in a way. And neither does the text say, we know you've seen almost this exact story before, but Isaac did it too. So modern scholars assume that what you had in the composition of the Bible were stories and blocks of texts that got put together over time. And sometimes the way they got put together was they just got stuck next to each other. And you can understand by reading the stories next to each other the difference between the two, much as if you had a conversation and you said, you know, my child did this, and someone else said, my child did that. If you heard the two, even though there's no connective tissue, even though someone doesn't say, oh, you told this story about your child, I'm going to tell this story about mine, you would understand that one comments on the other. So the story of Isaac comments on the story of Abraham and vice versa, even though it doesn't say so. And Isaac is, as you can understand, a little more passive, but also he's very wealthy. Isaac sowed in that land and reaped a hundredfold the same year. Okay? He is the first and only successful farmer in Bereshit, in Genesis. Which is a really interesting thing. You start to build up a picture about Isaac, right? Isaac stays in the land, he's connected to the land. Herders and shepherds and hunters are much more adventurous, much more risk-taking in a different way. And the farmer stays where he is, and in this he's a contrast to Abraham, but you need him too, as you'll see in just a minute. I'm going to read you a really interesting passage from Nechama Leibovitz. And while he's there, the Philistines stopped up all the wells which his father's servant had dug in the days of Abraham, filling them with earth. And Avimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you have become far too big for us. We're going to come back to that line in just a minute. So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the Vadi of Gerar, where he settled. Isaac dug anew the wells which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, which the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham's death, and he gave them the same names that his father had given them. Okay? That's already a statement about Isaac, a very powerful statement about Isaac, right? I remember reading once that Emerson's father was a preacher, and what Emerson did was he took his father's notebooks, ripped out the sermons that his father gave, and used the same notebooks for his essays. But his essays were very different from his father's sermons, right? In fact, Emerson started off as a preacher and gave up the pulpit because he could no longer believe what he was supposed to believe in order to be able to preach. He also said that he didn't like being a preacher because official goodness rebels against real goodness. In other words, if you're supposed to be good, then you can't really be good, right? Because you're doing your job when you're being good. So everybody says, well, of course he's being good because that's his job. We pay him to be good. Although it's fair to say that you can pay someone to be good and they can still be rotten. So being good gets some small credit. This is what Nechama Leibovitz, remember, a modern Israeli commentator just died a few years ago. This is what Nechama Leibovitz has to say about the passage we just read. Okay? First of all, why did they stop up the wells, the Philistines? He says, surely they were cutting off their nose to spite their face, withholding benefits from both themselves and their own cattle. Right? Nobody wants to stop up wells. Everybody needs water. But in addition to stopping the wells up, they filled them with earth so that no one would be able to know there was a well there. I mean, it's not just that they stopped them up. They disguised their existence, which already, by the way, may be a hint that Avimelech may be a good guy and they may have some morals, but this is a society that is not, that does not deserve to perpetuate itself. Why did they wish the land to be desolate? This question has puzzled students of the Torah throughout the ages. I love that phrase, right? She's about to give you some of their answers. There must be something more to the matter than is literally stated. Here we quote an interesting answer propounded by Haktav HaKabbalah, and this is what he says. He says that each well was called by some religious name, right? That's what Abraham did. He called the well something like, you know, Adonai Yireh, just like he called the areas that he, the mountains and so on. So all of them were a testament to the divine presence. By this he'd arise awareness of the truth. And therefore, when he died, since the people around him reverted to idolatry, in order to erase from their memory the names of these wells, which recalled the opposite of their false opinions, they stopped them up. With the disappearance of the well, the name also disappeared. As long as you left a hint of the well there, people would say, let's redig that well, the Lord will see, right? Because that was the name of the well. In the ancient world, that was, I mean, even today that's true, we just don't think about it. What does Los Angeles mean? City of Angels, right? We just, since we don't think about it, but we name things the same way that they did in the ancient world. The Torah comes to inform us that Isaac followed in his father's footsteps and endeavored to dig out the same wells and to resurrect their names in order to restore the crown of true faith to its former glory. He says that's why it points out that he gave them their names back. And that's why they tried to erase them, because they were erasing the very memory of Abraham's faith, which they found an insult to their own idolatry. So that's his, which is a very nice explanation, but she goes further. Here it says, the Torah tells us briefly why this is so. Verse 14, if you notice in verse 14, what does it say? He acquired flocks and herds and a large household, so the Philistines envied him. And Isaac himself said in verse 27, now you can go to verse 27, which we haven't, why have you come to me seeing that you've been hostile to me and driven me away from you? So there's a clear antipathy. Right? The Philistines don't like Isaac, and he knows that they don't like him. Was this reaction characteristic only of the Philistines 3,500 years ago, where Isaac dwelt in his tent and wells were dug with primitive instruments, or can it be paralleled in every generation, even in our own atomic age? Avimelech's words to Isaac surely strike a familiar note. And Avimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. And this is what Leibovitz has to say. The whole history of the Jewish people
is marked by expulsions from their homeland, from one exile to another, from one town to another, from village to village, from one quarter of a city to another, and this can be paralleled in the history of the patriarchs. In our Sidra, we have, therefore, the first expulsion. Remember that she's writing this sitting in Jerusalem, right, in the modern state of Israel. Okay, so then she says that also, redigging the wells of one's father is not just literal, but metaphorical, right? Wells are Mayim Chayim. Torah is called Mayim Chayim, right? Which means living water. Not only that, but wells are the one place that everyone gathers. Over and over again in the Torah, husbands and wives meet at wells. And so if you want a place to proselytize in the ancient world, that is to tell people about Torah, where would you go? You go to the well, right? In the same way that, why is the Torah read on Monday and Thursday during the week? Anyone know? They were market days. So you go to the market, and that's where you read the Torah, because that's where everybody is, right? Which, by the way, lets you know that not everybody was in the synagogue. They were all at the market. The difference is that at Century City, nobody's reading Torah. But those were market days. That's where you read Torah. The same thing with restoring the wells is restoring the place where you can spread Torah to people. What's that? The water cooler, exactly. It is the ancient water cooler in a literal sense. Okay, so Avimelech was ashamed to tell Isaac to leave. This is from Alshich, who was a past medieval times, like 18th century commentator. He allowed people to stop the wells in hopes that Isaac would take the hint and leave. So long as the king did him no direct harm, Isaac kept quiet. Besides, he didn't want to inform on the servants to their masters. But when Avimelech saw that Isaac wasn't to be moved by half measures, he took matters into his own hands and said to him personally, "Go away from us." So Alshich sees this as a part of a campaign to get Isaac to leave. Stop up his wells and he'll leave. When he doesn't leave, finally says, obviously the guy can't take a hint, and he says to him explicitly, "We want you to go." Yeah.
In Tasmania, off Australia, the British poisoned the wells of the natives in Tasmania who all died, and then they take over the land. So who are the kind of people who would do that? Well, the same kind of people who settled here,
right,
and fought the Indians.
And gave tubercular blankets. I remember when my brother went to Amherst College. And in the second year, I remember his coming home and telling us he found out more about John Amherst, and now he's a little uncomfortable about going to Amherst, because Amherst was instrumental in giving tubercular blankets to the Indians, which cleared the land, amazingly enough. And you say that as though it didn't happen a lot. When settlers come and they find people in land that they want throughout history, they take... This is off the topic a little bit, but one of the reasons why we're so uncomfortable with what goes on in the Bible is only because we hide from the rest of history, right? When it says wipe out the Canaanites, and we say, oh my God, how could they wipe out the Canaanites? Every land begins in conquest, every land. And it is an unfortunate people whose history is preserved. That's why what the founding of modern Israel makes us so uncomfortable, because people were kicked out of the land. But guess what? If you went back to the founding of France or the founding of England, England we know, at least part of it, or the founding of any land, and certainly the founding of the United States, you have acts of at least terrorism and at most genocide. So poisoning wells, just if you study imperial history, and Britain was just about as good as empires got, which is not, which as you've just heard, is nothing. You don't want to be on the receiving end of the empire. Yeah.
Where in the Bible is it Deuteronomy that you were saying that soldiers are not allowed to cut down trees? Where does it say?
I can find you the verse. It is Deuteronomy, but I don't remember which verse. Yes. Yep. But that's preserving the land, not its inhabitants. Anyway, that's part of what makes, and the history of the Jews as stateless people, as you hear, is to be a victim of that. Yeah.
Is there some connection between the wells and the Sefirot?
I don't know. The Sefirot are the the emanations of God? Are there connections between the wells and the sefirot? I mean, the Kabbalists use wells as metaphors all the time, and they use sefirot, sometimes they call them buckets, to receive God's overflow. But I don't know if specifically here, although my guess would be that if you looked at something like the Zohar on this passage, it would make that connection. I don't know of one, but it's a good guess, and I'm assuming that there is. The names of the wells? We don't have the names of the wells. He's just speculating, so no. The sefirot come from a verse. The names of the sefirot come from a verse in Proverbs, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, all of them, right. There was one other. Ha'emek HaDavar has one other explanation. Those who lived in Gerar, the capital city, presumably they include many wealthy people. One rich man is jealous of another. So first of all, jealousy is built into wealth, says Ha'emek HaDavar, and particularly if that man is a Jew. That is, particularly if there are Jews who are wealthy, they're going to attract the jealousy of the non-Jewish population. Remember that Ha'emek HaDavar is writing in Eastern Europe, right? The Philistines stopped them up, the country dwellers. He couldn't complain about a king since he lived in Gerar and had no means of knowing who was responsible. The government, too, turned a blind eye out of animosity. He has a different interpretation. He says the poor people were jealous of the rich people and they tried to destroy their source of wealth, that it wasn't the king doing it, it was others. And then eventually, this is what he says at the bottom. The text implies that a similar fate will befall the Jews in the dispersion when they will be restricted in their right of domicile, and he wrote that in the Pale of Settlement in Russia. So he doesn't see this as coming from the top, which the previous writer did. He sees it as coming from the bottom, but the king has to say, get out of here because you're causing unrest in my kingdom, right? So it is possible that the dislike of the Jews will percolate up or will be from the top. But either way, Isaac stands out as somebody who believes differently and is rich in their midst, so they don't like it. Okay. Any other well comments? Okay. So the one other addendum to this story that I want to give you is, here's a really nice, this is a really nice setup for Rebecca taking over, okay? Cass sets this up very nicely. His next section is, in fact, called Rebecca to the Rescue. But here it goes. Although he succeeded in providing food and water, and he's grown prosperous and gained recognition and a place in the land, Isaac has not succeeded as a patriarch of the new way. He hasn't succeeded the way Abraham does. Remember that Abraham made all these converts, right? It seems like Isaac is not succeeding with the people around him, because it says they stopped the wells up after Abraham died. They didn't dare stop them up when Abraham was around, right? But the kid who took over the business, you can push him around. True, he's made his own way as a man in the world and reopened the life-preserving channels begun by his father, but he's fallen short as a transmitter of his father's way of life. He not only prefers the wrong son, and for a wrong reason, unlike his father, he makes no provision for the marriage of his children, not even his favorite son, Esau. Right? We didn't think about that, but Cass notices it. Remember that Abraham sends Eliezer and was very careful to get the right wife, whereas Isaac does nothing. Doesn't get Jacob married off, doesn't get Esau married off. And the people that Esau marries, right, they end up not liking, well, in the end. To call the reader's attention back to this deficiency, the last verses of the chapter report that Isaac's worldly successes point to Isaac's failure. Because Esau, at the revelatory age of 40, right? Esau is also 40, just as Isaac was when Isaac found Rebekah, or more accurately, Rebekah found Isaac. Esau, at the age of 40, quite on his own, takes two Canaanite wives, wives who were, quote, a bitterness of spirit to both Isaac and Rebekah. Right? So he ends up marrying people whom Isaac doesn't want him to marry either. And that's in part because apparently Isaac didn't give the kind of direction that Abraham did, which we can return to in a second. I don't want people to take that too literally. Isaac, though materially blessed and prospering, averted his gaze from the future and the past. He lived with little awareness of what he and he alone can transmit. He's the only one who can do it, right? He's the one who inherited it from Abraham. And if he doesn't do it, who is going to? It reminds me, for example, of Maimonides, right? Rambam, the greatest Jewish scholar in the history of the Jewish people. He had a son named Abraham, son of, you know, Abraham, son of Moses. And he was 17 when his father died. But he spent the rest of his life not just producing his own scholarship, but collecting all the teachings and reporting everything that his father had told him that other people wouldn't know. And so we have a lot about the Rambam that exists because his son took care, you know, he recognized who his father was and took care to keep his legacy. When Esau, his favorite, takes foreign wives, even Isaac is dismayed. The covenant with Abraham is in grave danger. Isaac seems impotent to save it. Rebecca to the rescue, right? And that's exactly what happens. Then Rebecca arranges for Jacob to get the blessing, and Rebecca sends him off to be married to the right people. In his case, it's not person, but people. So with Isaac, you do come to, I mean, some things get emphasized, but other things are sort of the end of the road, and Rebecca has to fulfill his deficiencies. But I want to emphasize Isaac's merits too. He acts as the chain of transmission by redigging his father's wells, by enabling his, at least one of his sons, to grow up in a home where clearly he's devoted still, although we'll see in a slightly different way, to his father's God. And also, he succeeds in business, right? Isaac does succeed in accumulating wealth, which obviously is going to matter later on when Jacob comes back, you know, and returns to Israel and can support a very large family, right? And part of it is on his own wealth, but clearly part of it is the wealth that he gets from his father. So I don't think that that's a distinction that we're ever entirely able to make. That is, God's blessing enables people to succeed, but a lot of people don't succeed even when they seem blessed. You know, there's this passage in the Talmud, and I wish I could quote it exactly. It's a great passage about two rabbis. And it said, one rabbi said, in order to make a living, what you really need to do is pray and study. And the other rabbi said, in order to make a living, you must pray and study and work. And then the Talmud says, many people have followed the counsel of the first rabbi and not succeeded, and others have followed the counsel of the second rabbi and succeeded. So I would say, had Isaac been a different person, he wouldn't have been able to carry out the blessing in his way. So you have to give him some credit. You can't give God all the credit. But there is this kind of strange dichotomy. That is, in traditional Jewish terms, God determines everything. God blesses everything. But still people venerate, people revere Isaac and Abraham and so on as great people, which would seem counterintuitive if God did everything. So they share credit.
God helps those who help themselves.
There you go. Yeah.
He possibly blind? I mean, Isaac is not just physically blind, but blind to the future. And mm-hmm. That's one of the ways that it manifests itself by not, you know,
yes.
providing
right.
Marriage, the proper people to marry.
Yes.
But also, you talked about being at the well and Abraham converting people. So I'm just wondering, is it just the concept of one God that they're promoting, because there's no Ten Commandments, there's no Torah, I mean, we haven't received...
That doesn't mean there's no Ten Commandments and no Torah, it just means that we haven't received it. That is, the extent to which Abraham or Isaac promoted a certain moral code is a subject of debate, but clearly God has certain expectations of them, right? So...
They're
proselytizing something, although... The principal thing that they're proselytizing is one God as opposed to idolatry. So, at least according to the rabbis. But it seems that even though there's some acknowledgement from Avimelech and others of the existence of one God, that you could have an acknowledgement of the existence of one God and still have idols all around, because we know that later Israel had idols all around and still acknowledged one God. So every time you dig up any ancient Israelite site, you get like zillions of fertility symbols, you know, little statues and so on. And you can almost imagine an ancient Israelite saying, it's true, I believe in one God, but, you know, it's not going to hurt. I'll put a little Buddha statue in, you know, it's like if you're lying in the hospital and the priest comes in and says, may I say a blessing for you? What do you say? No, I don't want your blessing. Say, you know what, another blessing, it couldn't hurt. And the more desperate you are, the more inclined you are to be what's called syncretistic. Syncretistic is a fancy name for you follow lots of different religions in the hope that one of them will benefit you. So it's true. All right, let me see if I can just zip through this covenant. From there he went up to Beersheba. I'm on verse 23. Now let's start at 20. 19. When Isaac's servants, digging in the Vadi, found there a well of spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, the water's ours. He named that well Esek, because they contended with him. And when they dug another well, they disputed over that one too, so he named it Sitnah. He moved from there and dug another well, and they didn't quarrel, so he called it Rehovot, saying, now at last the Lord has granted us ample space to increase in the land. So you can see there's a clear power struggle going on here. From there he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, I'm the Lord of your father Abraham. Fear not, I'm with you. I'll bless you and increase your offspring for the sake of my servant Abraham. So he built an altar there and invoked the Lord by name. By the way, notice what God says. I will increase you. Why? Because of your father. So again, Isaac is not an entirely independent agent in his actions with God, right? Isaac pitched his tent there, and his servants started digging a well, and Avimelech came to him from Gerar with Achuzat, his counselor, and Phicol, the chief of his troops. He does not come alone, okay? When you come with the chief of your troops, you're saying, yes, you know, this is an entirely voluntary covenant, and should you decide not to enter it, please talk to Vinny, you know? Isaac said to them, why have you come to me, seeing you've been hostile and driven me away from you? And they said, we now see plainly that the Lord has been with you. One way to read this is, we now see you're capable of paying big taxes, right? You're very wealthy and you've accumulated a lot of influence and so on. But also another way to see it really is that. That is, wealth and success is a sign that you have the divine favor. So they see Isaac, they see that no matter how many times they stop up his wells or send people to harass him, he seems to continue to prosper. So in the ancient world especially, somebody would say, you know, clearly this is somebody who has what they call in Hebrew protexia, right? That God's watching out for him. Let there be a sworn treaty between our two parties, between you and us. Let us make a pact that you will not do us harm, just as we have not molested you, but always dealt kindly with you and sent you away in peace. Right? He's rewriting history a little bit, right? We said go away. Now he's saying we sent you away in peace. From now on, be you blessed of the Lord, which is a little, you know, it's not Avimelech's place to bless Isaac of the Lord. He's just said he's already been blessed. But he's trying to make the best of, you know, just like you'll see now, all these people who supported other candidates will say, you know, right, exactly. There was a time when, but really my heart was always with the guy who won.
Are they becoming converts of God now?
That's why I said they speak in the language of one God, but there's no indication that it's more than speaking Isaac's language to him. So early in the morning, they exchanged oaths. Isaac bade them farewell. They departed from him in peace. That same day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well they had dug and said to him, we found water. He named it Sheva. Therefore, the name of the place is Beersheba to this day. Sarna says about that, one would expect then that the wall would be called Shvua, which means oath, rather than Sheva, which means seven. The anomaly proves that the present story presupposes a knowledge of the earlier one, recounted in Abraham and Avimelech, where the number seven predominates. So the two stories tie together, which is why it's called Beersheba, or else it was always called Beersheba, or for a different reason called Beersheba. It's hard to know. Anyway, when Esau was 40 years old, he took to wife Judith, son of Beri the Hittite, and Basmath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah. So you'll see, by the way, when you come later on, it's going to be important when Rebekah says to Isaac, I got to send Jacob away, she prefaces it by saying, you know, I don't want him to marry a Hittite woman like Esau did, so he's got to leave. Yeah.
So we're supposed to assume that little extra paragraph now is jumping back forward in time?
Yes. Well, right.
Is there anybody who has read this entire section as though it is in real time, so that when they stay in Gerar, it's already after they've had their children and the boys are now grown and maybe have their own tent?
Well, the Gerar and the Wells thing, yes, but not with the original wife-sister story. I don't know of anyone who reads the wife-sister story as being after their adults, but there could be.
I mean, it could be.
Go ahead. How?
Really that what he was doing was protecting Rebecca, not himself.
Because she had children?
No, maybe she still was beautiful. Maybe he was...
But that would be true, that's true whether she has children or not, no?
Yeah, but I'm just asking if there's anybody who's read it that way.
The only thing, I mean, you, I would, yeah. Well, it's not just the bit at the end that goes back. I'm assuming that Isaac and the Wells is already back, could already be back with kids. It could be. It doesn't have to be. But yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like a postmodern novel, which does that too, and you have to figure out what goes where. In fact, there's a book by Julio Cortazar called Hopscotch, and you're supposed to be able to read it in any order. You can read any; it's a novel, and you can read it. It's a very well-known modernist novel, but you're supposed to be able to hopscotch, and you're supposed to be able to open it up at any page and read it. And you know,
is it on the 10 bestseller list?
No, it's not. It's not. You're right. I stand corrected. But the Bible is, even though it does the same thing. Yeah.
What's that? Is this the idea behind
quantumly
going back and forth?
Yeah, the idea here is that the assumption of the rabbis, when they read through the Torah, they saw many places where the story doesn't make sense if it's chronological. But they understood that it does in interesting ways illuminate the characters. And so they came up with this principle, Ein Mukdam U'Muchar B'Torah, there's no early or late in the Torah, which does two things. First of all, it allows them to talk about Abraham following the commandments at Sinai. And if you say, how could you say Abraham followed the commandments at Sinai? They'll say, Ein Mukdam U'Muchar B'Torah, right? There's no early and late. Everything applies to everything else. So they read the Torah non-linearly, right? They always assume that that's why you can quote a verse in Psalms that explains Abraham's behavior in Genesis. Even though everybody says David wrote Psalms and David lived, everybody agrees, 1,000 years after Abraham, even so. But it also allows them to explain stories in ways that make sense when they don't make sense. No, that begins with the creation of the world. That begins with the creation of the world. Abraham is, the Exodus is usually considered around 1300 BCE, Abraham 15 to 17, depending on who you read and look at, yeah. But that's why the principle is helpful, because then it allows you to at times say, this character couldn't have done it because he didn't know that. And the rabbis will say that at times. But it allows you to do the reverse as well, which is to say, clearly he was influenced by this understanding of what would happen later, right? Yeah.
I have two questions. First one is, until now, has there been any indication that there's only one God?
Any indication in the Bible?
Yes.
Yeah, sure, the very first sentence. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Moses. like with all the other patriarchs, do we get
okay.
Do we get better conception of God?
Off the top of my head, I would say the answer is you get to see different sides of God. Yes. But so in that sense, you get a theological development. So for example, Abraham has a dream of the covenant of the pieces, but Jacob has a dream of angels descending and ascending the ladder. That dream gives you a different feeling about God than the first dream. The idea that God told them that they were going to go down to Egypt and arranged it by the brothers selling Joseph into slavery tells you that God works through the tendencies of human beings and their free will. I mean, that kind of thing, but not, yeah. What?
The well thing, I just wanted to say, is that's the basis of the source, the Mishnah book. Huh. And it's also in the I Ching, the only two man-made things are the well and the cauldron. Mm-hmm. And the well is the connection of people to their earth. So these things about the well, I don't know about the spirit, but I know that in kind of a really deep the nature of how civilizations start and all that, the wells seem to me to have a tremendous kind of story here, as well as the struggle between the wells.
Wells are fundamental to the existence of any civilization, right? I mean, you can't have anything unless you find a water source. So one of the reasons why wells play this recurrent role in the Torah, and why the Torah is called Mayim, right? Why is it called water? Because it's a source, fount of living waters, because water, without water, you've got nothing. And it's why, you know, I'll close with something that my brother said when he was here. My brother, who's a sociologist, teaches at Penn, when he was here, he talked about the fact that if you could go back in history and change one thing to make the fate of human beings better than it has been through history, the one thing you would change is to give them decent drinking water. Contaminated water has killed more people than any other single source: cholera, dysentery, so on. Still does in parts of the world. And he said, and isn't it ironic that today, in our world, you can turn on the tap and you can get drinking water that is purified to the billionth part of certain chemicals. And what do? We buy bottled water. Right, exactly. Right, which is not regulated. Which just tells you something about how far we are from the world in which a well was. It was a life-giving source. And when you said a well to a medieval or ancient person, they understood that this was everything, everything, everything. And the metaphor of the well, I mean, also, the well has other metaphors. It's deep, you know, you draw up from it, all that kind of stuff. But the idea of poisoning wells or having wells, I mean, they're, without that, you have nothing, nothing, nothing at all. So that they stopped up wells is particularly horrible, right? We passed over it. Oh, they stopped up the wells, right? But in the ancient world, it's an unthinkable thing to do. And that Isaac restored his father's wells also has endless, you know, endless implications and recurrences. So, yeah.
Can you tell us how they survived having blocked up wells?
I guess they found new ones. I don't know. I mean, that's the best I can do. We can talk a little bit next time about the pact. There's one or two things to say about that, but really we're going to get on now to the rivalry between the brothers and the stolen birthright, and whether Jacob has any justification for having stolen it.